this program are not necessarily shared by Radius Communications Incorporated, operators of 91.3 FM CJTR.
When you're growing up in a small town, when you're growing up in a small town, when you're...
Well, it's Wednesday morning, so I guess it's time for us to do Untitled, your weekly introduction into events, exhibitions, art stuff that's happening around the city. And I'm your host, Felipe Diaz, and joining me as always is Margaret Basai. Good morning, Margaret.
Good morning, Phil.
How are you today?
I'm damp.
Damp.
Faintly damp.
Well, when I woke up this morning, you know, I was kind of groggy and still wanting to sleep in some more, and I discovered it was rainy and dark outside, which I think is why I wanted to continue sleeping. But I was rubbing my eyes trying to think about what to say about our artists today.
So, yes, because we're inviting everyone to come down to the club and check out carvings by Jerry Moskal.
Yeah.
And the club, I don't know if we've talked about this place too often. 8th Avenue and what's the crossover? If you've gone over the railway tracks, you've gone too far. It's on the other half of the Exchange.
Yeah.
So if you're used to going to music concerts at the Exchange, instead of going into the big hall side, just go in through the little double doors that say members only and enjoy some artwork, because it's a bar and an art gallery.
It is, so you can have, you know, a drink or whatever, settle down and enjoy, you know, a cup of something, and then look at some art while you're at it. That's an interesting trend, though. I'm going to go on a bit of a segue here, because I think that there's something worth mentioning just in that particular bit of information. And one of those things is the idea of having artworks or the way that we've shifted the venue of art from the gallery into a more public sphere. So what you've been starting to see in, I don't know, in Canada in the last 10 or 15 years is much more prominence of the cafe or the bar as a venue for artworks.
Absolutely. So much so that CARFAC, which is the artists' union, which likes to have published material on hand to help artists in their daily business practice, wrote an agreement that a restaurant and an artist can use that just basically covers all the details that people might overlook. Like, you know, if a piece of art falls off the wall and gets broken, who's responsible for it?
Exactly.
That sort of thing.
Yeah.
But that was a relatively new piece of information for them to write.
Yeah.
So,
and so this is definitely the case here, where you have a bar that operates as a gallery as well, which, I don't know, it's kind of an interesting idea. I'm not sure how I feel about it all the time, but nonetheless, there you have it. So it makes for a more informal viewing space, which, you know, is to the benefit of the viewer in a lot of senses, because then you can sort of take a bit of time, relax, think about other things, and then go back to the artwork if you want to, and sort of try to get into that kind of space in a particular way, which there is, you know, in a more formal setting like the Mackenzie, or the Dunlop, or any of the other ones. You're sort of on the spot when you walk right in, and so this gives you another opportunity. It's another way of looking at art, I guess.
Well, my thinking with the gallery space is always that at the moment you walk in, you know, everything that you will see is art. You know, it's like walking to a supermarket or a church. You know what that architectural space is dedicated to. Mm-hmm. So right away, a lot of people don't want to open those doors. So at the Dunlop, which is located in a library, a lot of people walk in by accident and find themselves in an art gallery. Which is great, you know, because you get a lot of people who wouldn't normally go see art. And that's the plus side on the club, I think, because people who wouldn't normally, like, they're just there. Let's say last night, I think Stepchild was playing.
Yeah.
So you get a lot of people who are going to go see that concert, maybe go to the other side and see Jerry's sculptures.
Right.
And they would never think, oh, I'm going to go to an art gallery now. They're just, you know, looking for the bathroom.
Well, exactly, right. And it's that informal setting that allows that to happen. And it, you know, it gives opportunities for artists to explore the way that art communicates an idea or communicates an emotion or a notion in a more informal setting, so that, you know, you can kind of take the viewer off guard a bit if you're ready to do.
Yeah, and I think the downside on that is you get a lot more consideration of, well, would that look good over my couch?
Yes.
You know, you don't always walk into a place like the Mackenzie or the Dunlop or Neutral Ground and see a piece of art that is highly intellectual and say, oh, yeah, but, you know, it's no good because it wouldn't look good over my couch. Whereas with the club, it's so informal and you're doing a lot of relaxing anyway. You start to think about the pieces up on the wall, like how they'd be in your home maybe.
Right.
So you're looking at a different kind of art sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like you're not always looking to be shocked or amazed, or maybe you want to be comfortable.
Who knows?
But yeah, it's interesting. I'm trying to think of a couple other venues in town that are beginning to show art. I think Roka Jocks has been doing it for years.
And the Free House?
The Free House has actually got, is considered an adjunct gallery space for the Rosemont Art Gallery,
right,
which is an interesting kind of thing. But the Free House has always been, had a good relationship with the arts community.
Bushwhackers also.
Really?
Yes.
Oh my goodness, I didn't realize.
They have a wall that they dedicate to local artists who can come in and put stuff up on there. And you know, with a lot of these places too, right, like the curatorial emphasis is not so much on what the exhibition is going to look like in the show, in the space, but rather let's just try to get something up on the walls, and you know, so long as it's not totally outrageous, then you know, they're pretty much willing to accept anything. So, you know, for emerging artists, it's a really good opportunity to go in and just put something up so that someone will see it, right?
For example, I think we went to see a show by a guy named Ed a couple months ago. Well, his artwork is now up at a place called Goomba's, which is in the South End. It's okay. Like a pizza sub place.
Right.
You know, and they met over the club and talked mm-hmm. about how Ed's artwork would look really good in this restaurant. And yeah, it's just, you know, so for people who didn't see Ed's work at the show, now they can go to this restaurant and they'll see Ed's work up on the
exactly.
walls there.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a good way to, it's a really excellent way of making some networks and some communications around your work, you know, without having to get into the gallery system, which can be very daunting, especially for emerging artists. You know.
Yeah, the downside is I don't know if this particularly leads to a gallery show.
Sorry, if
showing in this sort of a venue would lead to a gallery show?
Well, it has for some people, and it doesn't for other people. I mean, it depends a lot. Okay.
Are we off topic?
We're way off topic.
Because
I could start talking about careers now and the way that you know, careers are established and the different kinds of art, right? We could talk about, you know, Jerry as being a commercial artist versus sort of like a gallery artist, right? And there's you know, a variety of different roles that those feed, and so showing at the club might benefit a particular role while it might be to the detriment of another.
Yeah, exactly. And so you've just basically announced that Jerry's a commercial artist.
I just said that, didn't I?
Because we've sort of been dancing around this, you know, we weren't really sure what Jerry was.
Right.
I mean, he's a reclusive artist. We know from his biography up on the wall that he's an older sculptor who actually took some drawing classes from Ernie Linder in high school,
right,
which would be the 50s.
Something like that.
Ernie Linder is pretty famous in Saskatoon and northern Saskatchewan as a landscape painter. And then it says here that Jerry also went to the University of Saskatchewan and studied in the art department there under Eli Bornstein and Bill Epp, and minored in art history. So here's a man who's very knowledgeable about different styles of art.
Yeah, and I think that for me is one of the linchpins for the exhibition, is this idea that he does know what he is doing, right? He's not
like an old fisherman who picked up a penknife and started to carve one day and became a folk artist,
yeah,
enshrined by the New York elite.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Which is a show we looked at the Mackenzie at Christmas time, isn't
right.
it?
Yeah, so it's a very different sensibility from the quote unquote folk artist or quote unquote naive artist, right? That they, you know, who are self-taught and who just choose to express whatever sort of thing is around them or whatever thing that they happen to be thinking about,
I think it's making connections from a different area, race.
Right. And
but Jerry has the ability to make connections with art history and other artists that he's known.
He's making some references within his work to other ideas and other concepts, which he would not have access to if he hadn't had that kind of formal education. So I think that puts his work into a different sort of realm, and it makes it a little different trying to understand where he's coming from and why he's done the images that he's done, which is the question that I kept asking myself throughout the show, is why choose to represent that, or why carve that particular thing?
Yeah, we're looking for an underlying principle or philosophy that would cohesively link all of the works in the show, which is what we would normally do when we walk into an art gallery and see a show that's been curated around an underlying principle or thought.
Right, and so, and just to make a footnote at this point about all that, right, is the idea that when I was going through the exhibition, I was trying to come up with this, whatever that underlying philosophy is, or whatever theoretical construct, who knows what, right? I was trying to come up with that the way I normally do with an exhibition. But then I thought to myself, is he really doing that kind of work? And do I need to be trying to engage with it that kind of way? So I guess I had to take a step back and sort of suggest to myself, well, maybe it's not about some sort of philosophy, and maybe it's not about trying to approach the world from that particular angle. Instead, maybe he's just trying to represent what he thinks is cool. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's in some ways he has sort of absorbed that, and I think this is what's so difficult about him at times. He has sort of absorbed that kind of folk art aesthetic, in the sense that here he is just trying to recreate for us those things that he finds interesting, or those little points in the world that are worth taking note of.
I'm glad you said that, Phil. It's sort of talking about folk art in terms of not so much what it looks like, but where the artist takes the inspiration from. Because I was about to call you on it and say, just, you know, whatever's abstract, because it seems to me that sculpture falls into two different categories in people's minds nowadays. Right. There's the realistic Dofofard cow, which is completely mimetic, and then there's the abstracted sort of folk arty guy who isn't completely realistic. Mm-hmm. And it's not two categories like that. Everyone who's a little bit abstract isn't, you know, a folk artist. Like, we were talking about the Lipschitz in front of the Mackenzie Art Gallery last night, which is totally not folk art. It's a giant bronze, but it's not a realistic sculpture either.
Right.
So by now you've nailed the folk artist as taking inspiration from things that they like. It sounded better when you said it.
just reflecting on the world around them, I think.
Reflect on the world around them. That's a really good phrase. Yeah, I could see him doing that. Yeah. You know, that he's working that way, but the world around him is colored somehow by what he knows. And I think we should talk about the work.
Yes.
You know, like, what do we mean when we say that, right? Because when you walk into the show, it's kind of a retrospective for Jerry. I mean, he's got work there from, I don't know, the early 80s all the way up to 2002, 2003. Yes. Yeah. And they're all, an intimate size sculpture.
Yeah, it's kind of like it would fit on an end table or a coffee table. They're wooden sculptures.
Yeah, they carved out of poplar and birch.
Maybe about a foot high. You know, some of them are hung on the wall, the masks in particular. But for the most part, they're just sort of objects that sit on a table or something like that. And again, about a foot high, maybe a foot wide or deep or something.
I think one or two of them went as far as 2 or 3 feet tall.
Yeah, but that's about it. Those were the exception rather than the norm in the exhibition. So it was very sort of small handheld kind of stuff is what we're looking at.
And it ranged in subject matter quite a bit. I really enjoyed Pierre the Waiter, who's about 2.5 feet tall, and he has this great nose that looks like a Dutch shoe. that was from 2001.
Right, pointing up. I think that's the key to that one.
The Dutch shoe pointing up, the nose. Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
The nose curves up.
All the way to, he had quite a few dragons.
Yeah, yeah.
And they sort of went from like 83 to like 2002.
Yeah, and he had a few masks that explored a variety of different vocabularies.
He named one Alien Mask. It looked like it was a portrait of somebody.
But it looked really representational, and there was a couple that were much more abstracted in the way that they used the shape. So, you know, the nose might be represented by a rectangle and blah, blah, blah. Right?
Yeah, he had one from 2001 called Abstract with Leaves.
Right.
And it really looked like it was informed by primitive African mask making.
Right. So, yeah, what was considered primitive at that time, yeah.
And by at that time, we're thinking Picasso, which is the 50s and 60s.
Exactly, right.
So we're lost in time and space.
And he had some very realistic-looking snakes.
Yeah, and strangely, they were all cobras.
Yes, yeah.
So no garter snakes or anything that would be more vernacular.
Except for the boa, right?
Well, the boa doesn't really exist in northern Saskatchewan either.
So... yeah, who knows?
See, I really liked the use of the poplar wood. To me, that's like Jerry's going out to the wood pile and finding some wood and carving.
Right.
Like it really speaks about using materials from your environment because he's living up north. He's in Whalen Bay.
Okay, so I think this is a good introduction at this point then to sort of another ongoing debate I think that we were having without having the debate, which was the idea of what is process-oriented art and what is object-oriented art, right? And what is the difference between the two?
Well, yeah, because I think of process-oriented artists enjoying the process of making stuff and not worrying too much about subject matter.
Yeah, and I would agree to a large part of that, although the subject matter part may
so we disagree on the subject matter.
Yeah. But I was thinking about this sort of this show as being very object oriented in that way.
Because you think he's making stuff that people want to buy.
But I think that he's the end result is what's important for him. Right, so...
See, and I think he's just whiling away the winters by going out to the woodshed and carving stuff. And then somebody said, wow, Jerry, you've carved a lot. You should have a show or you should sell these. And he is represented by two galleries up north.
Right, and...
And that's what kind of made you think that he's making stuff to sell.
Sort of. I think that's part of it. But it's also another important part of it is recognizing the way that he's approached the material, right? Like they've got a finish to them, like there's a certain degree of completion around each one. Like the snakes look realistic, right, to the point where, you know, they fool the eye, right?
Well, having never actually seen a real cobra, I can't really go with you on that one.
But you get a sense of what a cobra looks like, right? And the kind of space that they take up.
So you don't think his dragons are realistic then, or?
No, I do. But I think that, jeez, blah 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 blah. I think for me, the important thing is for him is the object at the end, what he's left with once he goes through this whole process of creating it. So it's not just like he likes the carving and he likes to go through that kind of experience, but. In the end, we are left with this thing, and that thing for him carries, or for me at any rate, seems to carry more weight with him than the actual process that he was undergoing trying to get there.
Well, see his subject matter is so varied that I think, you know, it doesn't really matter to him what it is that he's carving.
Well, yes and no.
Like it's not all being carved up towards some sort of great philosophical statement. He's not creating each of these pieces that they fit into an integral equation or like an essay like you would find in a regular gallery, right?
Right?
That he's just going out to the woodshed and he's like, I'm going to carve something today. But I saw this great documentary on PBS about, you know, Eastern Asian dragons, and I really like that look, and I'm going to try that.
But I would disagree to an extent, because I think that he's still engaging in some sort of identification that he's having with the objects around him, with the images around him, right? So he's making things that, again, he finds interesting to make. And
so what artist doesn't do that?
Well, yeah, that's my point exactly, right? Is that we can't really escape it. Like, it's not like he's just sort of like pulling something out of the air and just making it, and then leaving it there. I mean,
I think that's exactly what he's doing.
Oh, I totally don't, because I think he's reflecting on something, right? And it's coming off of what he's going. That's why it's so important that he went through this university training. Like that for me is that's why it's one of those linchpins for this exhibition, because then you can start thinking about the fact that he knows how to look at things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's a visually literate person.
Okay.
So he knows how to look at things, and then he knows how to interpret them into himself, and then produce something out of that. Right. So the Inuit hunter sculpture.
Now that is just the most amazing piece, because it's a sculpture that looks almost exactly like an Inuit piece of carved soapstone.
Exactly.
But it's out of poplar wood.
Right. So he's reinterpreting the things that he is looking at, and reinterpreting them into his own medium at his own place. Right. So it's a way of re-identifying with these objects and internalizing them into another location, right? Like, for me, the Inuit hunter piece was really strange. Like, when I first looked at it, I couldn't figure it out. Like, why do that? Because, you know, it... why? Like,
'cause he liked it.
Right, but he's also making a point about who he is and where he is, right? So, he likes... Inuit sculpture, and he likes to look at it or whatever, engage with it, but then, you know, the appeal for him is so great that he has to reinterpret it, and he can only reinterpret it within the medium that he has chosen to express himself in the materials that he has chosen to express himself in. So that's why the poplar sculpture of an Inuit hunter becomes so so intriguing, you know, for me. Like, I looked at it for a while, and it took me a long time to figure out why you would want to do that. Do you follow me?
I do, but I don't understand how we're disagreeing and agreeing at the same time, because I think he likes Inuit sculpture and thought, wow, that's really cool, and then he recreated it in wood because that's what he works with.
Right, but then in order to get to, like, but just going on that and trying to get to that underlying...
I don't see how that places him in time and space and deals with his questions of identity.
It does for me to a large extent, if you think about someone living in the northern part of Saskatchewan.
So the choice of material, right?
Yeah, like you know, there's a particular purpose to that. Like, why use poplar and birch? Why not use ebony?
Because it's cheap,
or
right?
Mahogany or teak.
It's out in the backyard.
Exactly, right? So it's wood from where he's from.
Yes, but right? The reason he chose an Inuit hunter sculpture, I think, is because he liked them.
No, and exactly, right? But it's that sort of relationship that he has with it that is so intriguing, right? Because, okay, I'm going to have another conversation about this on the side at the same time. Because one could easily sort of look at that kind of sculpture and say, well, he's appropriating some other kind of imagery.
Well, he's definitely doing that.
Right. And so there's this...
But the word appropriation has got really nasty connotations in today's art world.
Exactly. Because we could be saying, well, you know, he's just sort of taking this image...
He's shamelessly stealing the imagery from another culture.
Exactly. Right. But why would... So then you have to ask yourself, and because he is visually literate, he must be aware of this. So you have to ask yourself, why would you want to do that?
Well, I don't know that he is aware of appropriation issues, because they weren't really in the forefront in the 1970s in the Canadian art world.
Yeah.
It's something that's come up in the 90s, really.
Right.
Recognizing that there are these cultural boundaries.
No.
The flip side of the ugliness of appropriation, we talk a lot about how First Nations art has taken off in the last 5 years with cultural fusion.
Right.
You know, and if you don't have that sort of crossover going between different cultures and ideas and materials, then you're dead.
Well, yeah, and that's kind of my point, right? Is that, you know, it's again, we have this idea of cultural fusion, and that the way that he's interacting with these with these other images, right, and then internalizing them in some way, and then expressing them out in his own vernacular.
Yeah, and there's definitely a cohesive style to the wood carving, like you can look at all of these pieces, and even though the subject matter is really varied, the way they've been carved is very, very similar.
So you have
that sort of auteur showing up in the knife work.
And that's why I'm saying he doesn't quite escape, like all that stuff put together is why he doesn't quite escape the idea of sort of like a random creation out of somewhere, like he just didn't just sit down and carve something for no good reason and then just put it up. Right, like that there is all these underlying reasons as to why they're done and the purpose of doing it.
Yeah, I don't think Jerry could articulate them to you, though.
No.
Right, and that's
not
the thing that I want to talk about when I talk about artists that enjoy doing the work and don't want to fuss too much about the theory.
Right.
You know, that those people really just like to do the motion, the carving, the photography. They really enjoy in that sort of craftsmanship.
Yeah, no, and totally, like, I can see him enjoying it because the pieces are really well made and they're, you know, he's got a very strong technique for doing that. But then I think underneath all those things there are these other dialogues that are happening, and trying to pinpoint them. I mean, they can be very elusive in this exhibition. And so trying to come up with, all right, well, what is the relationship between one piece and another piece and the third piece, and trying to figure out where Jerry sits in all that becomes very awkward.
Well, it could be very personal, right? That if you talk to Jerry about the pieces, like we just, there's a kind of a skull, swami, water buffalo, motorcycle helmeted, I don't know, to me it's something from the Hell's Angels, right? It's a skull with the helmet on and it's got horns coming off.
Right.
And to you, Phil, it was the Flintstones.
It was.
Flintstones meets Hell's Angel.
Yeah.
It's a fun piece, right?
Yeah, it's a little strange, but at the same time, you know, there are all these icons within it that are trying to surface at the same time, and he pays equal attention to them. So, you know, you never really get to a point where it's about this or it's about that. You know, you just sort of end up trying to, well, basically guess as to
if you talk to Jerry, he would say, well, I had this friend and he was named Hank and he liked this thing and I carved it for him and, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So.
And then the other thing that I found really interesting, because I keep going back to this idea of appropriation, both historical and cultural, is the carved Indian chief.
That's just
like, why is that there? and
I don't even know the history of carved Indian chiefs. As far as I know, they are store displays for tobacco stores in what, the States, or, you know, there's an association between First Nations people and tobacco.
Yeah.
So then tobacco stores would then somehow get a sculpture of an Indian and put it in front of their store to signify that they sold tobacco products.
Exactly.
So there is a whole history of vernacular sculptors out there who carved these things, and like what band or tribe is represented, I don't know. I think it's like a Sioux warrior with like a big, you know, feather headdress on, usually seated, holding a cigar, a pipe. I can't remember. I think a pipe.
Yeah.
So there's this whole thing there. And I'm sure if we went into Antiques Roadshow, we get like, you know, the whole history of them. Yeah. But I don't know that history too well. So then Jerry's carved one.
Yeah, Jerry's carved one. So again, I had to ask myself, why would you do that? Right? Because there's so much in contemporary art culture that there's so much movement against that kind of a representation, and so to do that kind of gesture
to reinforce that stereotype, I guess.
Yeah, he's trying to say something, right? Like it's not a blank statement. There must be something there, and I just haven't quite penetrated it. It's the same thing with the Inuit hunter, right? Like it's the same sort of gesture, and so trying to figure out how they play themselves out within the show and the relationship to who he is, where he is, and what the other pieces in the exhibition is becomes very difficult, but at the same time it's very intriguing. I'm so curious, and I don't know, you know, how to answer all those things.
Well, one thing I learned when I was working at CARFAC, which is a province-wide association, is that the culture in southern Saskatchewan and the culture in northern Saskatchewan are widely different.
Yes.
And the people in southern Saskatchewan don't really recognize that, because we think of ourselves as being Saskatchewan.
Right.
Like if people say, where are you from? You're from Regina. It's actually southern Saskatchewan. There's a whole lot of north above us. And even Saskatoon is the midpoint in the province.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a very urban culture and really in touch with this sort of urban gallery place. But you go up north and there's a whole other thing happening there. not only for white artists or Aboriginal artists, there's just a different way of doing things and a different way of thinking about things. And I don't know what the discussions are around appropriation or cultural stereotypes. You know, does that sort of thing exist? Is that appropriate? Is it not appropriate? You know, and I think that perhaps we have to do a little bit more research into Northern culture to see how that plays out up there. Because it's playing out differently down here.
Absolutely.
Have we run out of time?
We ran out of time. We're going over now. So, go and see Jerry Moskal. Is that
Jerry Moskal at the club.
At the club.
Until August 31st. So you've got all summer to pop into the club, have a beer, play a game of pool, and...
And look at some really wonderful wood carving.
Oh, and all the art's for sale. Yeah. So you can buy some, too.
And then this weekend, on Saturday, beginning at 1 o'clock at the Central Gallery of the Central Library Branch, the Dunlop Art Gallery will be having an opening for their exhibition Off the Map. So you should come and see that as well. There'll be performances and a panel discussion and a bus tour. So lots to see. Okay, everyone. Have a good week.
Have a good weekend.
The trouble with an impressionist?
Thanks.
He looks at a log. He doesn't know who he is staring at this log. And surrealist memories are too amorphous and proud. While those downtown macho painters are just alcoholic. The trouble with an impressionist? There's the trouble with an impressionist. There's the trouble with an impressionist. There's the trouble with an impressionist. Trouble with personality.